Welcome to Literary Depths, where this entire episode is generated by AI, including the voices you're hearing. Today's episode is brought to you by the completely fictional ReadEase Digital Bookmark, the smart device that tracks your reading progress across all formats. Remember, that's entirely made up, folks. Please double-check any facts we discuss today, as AI can sometimes hallucinate details. I'm Marco Benedetti, and today we're diving into a fascinating piece of early Italian science fiction that often gets overlooked. Sussi e Birribissi. Storia di un viaggio verso il centro della Terra, from Ninetina Utu.
Thanks for having me, Marco. I'm Elena Rossi, and I specialise in early 20th century Italian literature. This novel by Paolo Lorenzini is truly a hidden gem that deserves more attention.
Our listeners who might not know Paolo Lorenzini, he was actually the nephew of Carlo Collodi, the creator of Pinocchio. But this book takes us in a completely different direction. Underground adventure, rather than fairy tale whimsy.
Exactly. And what's remarkable is how Lorenzini was writing in the shadow of Verna's Journey to the Center of the Earth, but created something distinctly Italian. The characters Sussi and Birribissi aren't your typical Victorian explorers. They're more like mischievous Italian schoolboys on the adventure of their lives.
The premise is wonderfully simple yet compelling. These two young friends discover a mysterious cave entrance and decide to explore it, not realizing they're about to embark on a journey that will take them to the very center of our planet.
What I love about Lorenzini's approach is that he doesn't burden us with extensive scientific explanations like Verna does. The boys simply stumble into their adventure through curiosity and boyish daring.
Let's talk about that underground world Lorenzini creates. It's quite different from other subterranean fiction of the time, isn't it?
Absolutely. Where Verne gives us geological lectures and scientific theories, Lorenzini presents an almost dreamlike landscape. The deeper Sussi and Birribissi go, the more fantastical their surroundings become.
The underground rivers of light, the crystal forests, the cities built into cavern walls. It reads almost like a precursor to modern fantasy literature. How does Lorenzini establish the rules of this world?
That's the brilliant thing. He doesn't really establish hard rules. The world operates more on dream logic than scientific principles. Gravity becomes lighter as they descend, time seems to stretch and compress, and the boys adapt to each new environment almost instinctively.
There's that wonderful sequence where they discover they can breathe underwater in the luminous lakes. No explanation given. It simply becomes possible because the story needs it to be.
And the way the narrative builds tension isn't through external dangers so much as through the boys' growing realization that they may never find their way home. The real threat is existential rather than physical.
Speaking of the boys, let's dive into these characters. Sussi and Birribissi are quite different personalities, aren't they?
They're perfectly complementary. Sussi is the dreamer. The one who sees beauty and wonder in every strange sight they encounter. He's constantly stopping to marvel at the underground aurora or the singing stones they find.
While Birribissi is more practical, always thinking about food supplies, finding shelter, mapping their route. But he's not just the cautious one. He has his own moments of pure wonder.
Exactly. There's that beautiful moment when Birribissi, the practical one, is the first to hear the music that the crystal formations make when the underground winds blow through them. Lorenzini shows us that wonder and practicality aren't opposites.
Their friendship evolves beautifully throughout the journey. They start as typical boyhood friends, competitive, sometimes squabbling, but the underground transforms their relationship.
The turning point comes when they get separated in the maze of mirror caves. For the first time, they experience real fear. Not of the strange creatures or treacherous paths, but of losing each other.
That sequence is genuinely haunting. Lorenzini doesn't shy away from the psychological horror of isolation. When Sussi hears what he thinks is Birribissi's voice calling from deeper in the maze.
But it's just echoes and his own desperate hope. The way Lorenzini writes Sussi's internal monologue there, it's heartbreaking. You really feel like a child lost in the dark, calling for your best friend.
And when they do reunite, they're different, more protective of each other, more aware of how precious their friendship is. The adventure becomes less about discovery and more about finding their way home together.
Which brings us to the characters they meet underground. The inhabitants of this subterranean world are fascinating. They're not quite human, but they're not alien either.
The luminous people who live in the crystal cities. They seem to communicate through changes in the light they emit rather than words. How do the boys learn to understand them?
Renzini handles this so elegantly. The boys don't learn their language in any conventional sense. They begin to feel the emotions behind the light patterns. It's empathy rather than translation.
And the luminous people's relationship with the boys is wonderfully ambiguous. They're not hostile, but they're not exactly helpful either. They seem puzzled by these surface dwellers.
I think they represent a different way of being. They've adapted completely to their underground environment. They don't understand the boys' desperate need to return to the surface because they've never known sunlight.
There's also the mysterious guide figure who appears intermittently throughout their journey. Never clearly described, always just at the edge of the narrative.
The guide is one of Lorenzini's most intriguing creations. Sometimes it seems like a person, sometimes like an intuition or inner voice. It leads them deeper when they need to go deeper, but also shows them the path home when they're ready.
Which leads us into the deeper themes of this novel. On the surface, it's an adventure story, but there's so much more happening underneath, isn't there?
The journey to the center of the earth is really a journey into the center of the self. As the boys descend physically, they're also descending into deeper levels of consciousness, facing fears and desires they didn't know they had.
There's a wonderful moment when Susie realizes he's been dreaming of being underground for years before they ever found the cave, as if the adventure was calling to him from his unconscious mind.
And Biribisi's dreams have always been of finding treasure, but when they encounter actual underground riches, the caves full of gems and gold, he realizes what he really treasures is the friendship and the experience itself.
The novel seems to be exploring the relationship between surface and depth in multiple ways. There's the literal underground journey, but also the metaphorical descent into the depths of friendship, courage, and self-knowledge.
Absolutely. And notice how the deeper they go, the more light they find. It's a complete reversal of what we'd expect. The center of the earth isn't dark and hellish. It's luminous and full of wonder.
That connects to broader themes about hidden knowledge and the rewards of curiosity. The boys are rewarded for their willingness to explore the unknown, even when it's frightening.
But Lorenzini also explores the cost of that knowledge. There's a melancholy running through the novel, the sense that once you've seen the wonders underground, the surface world might never seem quite as magical again.
There's also a fascinating tension between individual adventure and social responsibility. The boys have to choose between staying in the underground paradise they discover and returning to their families and normal life.
That choice isn't presented as obvious or easy. The underground world offers them freedom, wonder, and adventure without end. The surface world offers duty, routine, and the constraints of growing up.
When they do choose to return, it's not because the surface world is better, but because love and loyalty to their families matter more than personal adventure. It's a mature theme for what could have been just a children's adventure story.
And the way Lorenzini handles their return is brilliant. They're not quite the same boys who left. They carry the underground world within them now, in their dreams, in their friendship, in their understanding of what lies beneath the ordinary world.
There's also a recurring motif of music throughout the novel. The singing stones, the harmonic crystals, the way the underground winds create melodies. What do you make of that?
I think music represents the universal language that connects all the different worlds in the novel. The boys can't speak with the luminous people, but they can share in the music that fills the underground spaces.
And it's music that finally guides them home, following the underground river, whose flow creates a melody that somehow harmonizes with the songs they remember their mothers singing.
That connection between the cosmic music of the underground and the intimate music of home and family. It's one of the most beautiful aspects of Lorenzini's vision. Wonder and love aren't separate things.
Now, let's talk about Lorenzini's craft as a storyteller. How does he structure this narrative to create such a compelling reading experience?
The pacing is masterful. He starts with a very realistic, almost mundane description of the boys finding the cave entrance. You could be reading any ordinary story about children playing outdoors.
But then he gradually introduces more fantastical elements, By the time we're in the crystal forests or the cities of light, we've been so carefully prepared that these wonders feel natural and believable.
And he uses an episodic structure. Each underground environment is like a separate adventure within the larger journey, but they're connected by the boys' evolving relationship and their growing homesickness.
Point of view is interesting too. It's third person, but it stays very close to the boys' perspectives. We see everything through their sense of wonder and fear.
Exactly. Lorenzini never breaks away to give us adult exposition or scientific explanation. If the boys don't understand something, neither do we. We're as lost and amazed as they are.
His descriptive style is quite poetic, isn't it? The way he describes the underground aurora, like scarves of coloured light dancing with invisible partners. That's pure poetry.
He has this wonderful ability to make the impossible feel tactile and real. When he describes the boys walking on paths made of crystallized music, somehow you can feel what that would be like under your feet.
The dialogue between Susi and Biribisi feels very authentic, like real boys talking, with interruptions, half-finished thoughts, and the kind of shorthand communication that close friends develop.
And notice how their way of speaking changes as they go deeper. They start to use words and phrases that seem to come from the underground world itself, as if the journey is changing not just what they see, but how they think.
Lorenzini also makes brilliant use of silence and empty space in his narrative. Some of the most powerful moments happen in what he doesn't describe directly.
Like when they first see the center of the earth itself, that moment of ultimate revelation. Lorenzini gives us the boy's emotional response, but leaves the actual vision mysterious. We have to imagine it ourselves.
That's such a sophisticated technique for 1902. He understands that some experiences are too profound for direct description. The reader's imagination becomes part of the creative process.
And structurally, the return journey isn't just a reversal of the descent. The boys take a different path home, and they see familiar places transformed by their new understanding.
Let's put this novel in its historical context. 1902 was an interesting time for Italian literature and for science fiction more broadly.
Italy was still a relatively new nation, still defining its literary identity. Lorenzini was writing in the shadow of his uncle's international success, with Pinocchio, but also in a period when Italian writers were looking for distinctly Italian voices in fantastic literature.
And internationally, this was the golden age of scientific romance. Wells, Verne, and others were establishing the conventions of what we now call science fiction. How does Lorenzini's work fit into that tradition?
He's less interested in scientific speculation than his contemporaries, more focused on the psychological and spiritual dimensions of the fantastic journey. In some ways, he's closer to the later tradition of magical realism than to hard science fiction.
The novel was initially published as a serial in a children's magazine, wasn't it? But it seems to work equally well for adult readers.
That's the mark of a truly great children's book. It doesn't condescend to its young audience. Lorenzini trusts children to handle complex emotions, moral ambiguity, and profound themes about friendship and growing up.
How was it received at the time? Did it find its audience?
It was moderately successful, but overshadowed by its more famous contemporaries. Italian readers seemed to prefer either more realistic novels or more conventional fantasy. Lorenzini's unique blend of dream logic and emotional realism was perhaps ahead of its time.
And how is it read today? Has it found new appreciation among contemporary readers?
There's been renewed interest in recent years, particularly among scholars of early science fiction and children's literature. Modern readers seem more prepared to appreciate Lorenzini's subtle approach to the fantastic.
It's interesting how some books have to wait for their proper audience. The themes of environmental wonder, deep friendship, and the psychological journey seem very contemporary.
Absolutely. In an age when we're more aware of the hidden complexities beneath surface reality, whether psychological, environmental, or social, Lorenzini's vision feels remarkably prescient.
Are there any contemporary works that remind you of Susi e Biribisi, writers who seem to be working in a similar vein?
I think of writers like Ursula Le Guin in her Earthsea books, or more recently writers like Neil Gaiman, who understand that the most powerful fantasy grows out of emotional truth rather than elaborate world building.
That's a great comparison. Both Lorenzini and Le Guin understand that the real journey is always internal, even when the characters are travelling through extraordinary external landscapes.
And both trust their readers to understand that adventure stories can be profound explorations of what it means to grow up, to be loyal, to choose between competing goods rather than obvious rights and wrongs.
So let's do our final assessment. What works brilliantly about this novel, and where do you think it might fall short for some readers?
What works brilliantly is the emotional authenticity. These boys feel like real children having real feelings about extraordinary experiences. The friendship is beautifully developed, and the sense of wonder never feels forced or artificial.
I'd agree completely. The underground world is genuinely magical without being cloying or overly whimsical. And the theme of choosing responsibility over endless adventure is handled with real maturity and complexity.
Where it might fall short for some readers is in the deliberately vague world-building. If you're looking for scientific explanations or detailed fantasy systems, Lorenzini isn't going to satisfy you. This is much more impressionistic.
And the episodic structure, while it works for the theme, might feel loose or wandering to readers who prefer tighter plots. Some of the underground encounters don't directly advance the story so much as deepen the mood.
But I'd argue that's a feature, not a bug. This is a novel about the journey being more important than the destination. The wandering and the wondering are the point.
So who should read this book? What will different types of readers take away from it?
Anyone who loved books like The Phantom Tollbooth or A Wrinkle in Time will find something to treasure here. It's perfect for readers who want fantasy that's grounded in real emotion and genuine friendship.
I'd also recommend it to adult readers who are interested in the history of children's literature or early science fiction. It offers a fascinating glimpse into how writers were thinking about childhood, adventure, and the unknown at the turn of the 20th century.
And honestly, it's a beautiful book to read aloud. Parents and children could share this journey together. The wonder is infectious, and the friendship between Sussi and Biribisi models the kind of loyalty and courage we all hope to find in our own relationships.
Elena, thank you so much for this wonderful discussion. Sussi e Biribisi is clearly a book that rewards careful reading and reflection.
Thank you, Marco. I hope our listeners will seek out this hidden gem. It's a reminder that the most profound adventures often happen when we're willing to descend into the depths, whether literal or metaphorical, with someone we trust completely.